Welcome to the History of Chemistry podcast. I'm Steve Cohen, your host, and this is episode 29, Electrons. In this episode, we learn how the first subatomic particle, the electron, was discovered. Thanks to those who already support this podcast. Support the continuation of this podcast at Patreon. The website is www.patreon.com/thehistoryofchemistry. Throughout the 19th century, as we recall, there was a great divide between chemical atoms, which on paper made chemical reactions work out nicely, and physical atoms, which were postulated but lacked significant evidence. Even the kinetic theory of gases assumed atoms and molecules, and like chemical atoms, kinetic atoms matched what scientists observed on the everyday scale. And in between, Arrhenius's idea of ionized molecules in solutions seemed to make sense, but no one could actually observe these charged particles. So atoms, if they existed at all, were pretty much unobservable, hypothetical entities, and many textbooks tried to avoid the uncomfortable topic at all. In the meantime, though, scientists continued to research electricity, which seemed to be a fluid-like property of matter, divided into positive and negative charges. You can separate a positive and negative charge, like in a battery, and create an electric potential between the two electrodes. The potential drives this fluid-like electricity from one electrode to the other until the charges are equalized to neutrality. You can measure how well electricity flows through materials. Metals conduct electricity easily, so even with a small potential, a current can flow through a metal. Salt solutions will do this too. Other non-metallic materials don't conduct electricity well. For example, ivory, wood, glass, stone, elemental sulfur, and so on. You really have to set up a huge potential difference to force electricity through these materials. And sometimes the materials will just chemically decompose instead. Air is an example here as well. Only very high potentials in the atmosphere will drive electricity through air, creating lightning. And there is a third category of materials, semiconductors, which allow a bit of electricity through, but not easily. Such elements as silicon, carbon in graphite form, and germanium are in this gray area between the conductors and non-conductors. Semiconductors will become important in the 20th century, but we aren't there yet. Of course, this whole classification scheme around electricity was purely empirical. No one knew what electrical current really was anyway. What about the absence of matter, that is, a vacuum? Can you get electricity to travel through a vacuum? This occurred to researchers like Michael Faraday, but his equipment wasn't good enough to create a decent vacuum. So we get to the middle of the 19th century, and Heinrich Geissler, a German glassblower and instrument maker in Bonn. He worked with the physicist Julius Plücker on fine-quality thermometers, and calibrated them with a sensitive balance able to detect 0.1 milligrams of mercury. By 1852, he also built a vaporimeter designed to determine the alcohol content of wine, which compared the pressure of alcohol vapors and air against mercury. Plücker improved the apparatus by doing this in vacuum, and a high-quality vacuum pump was needed. Geissler's answer was a pump made of glass and thick rubber. You operated it by moving a second tube up and down manually with mercury. If the height of a column of mercury at sea level is about 760 millimeters, as Torricelli showed in the 17th century, then Geissler's pump could deliver a vacuum at 1/1000th of 1 millimeter. Using the new mercury air pump, Geissler began constructing small glass globes with metal electrode wires embedded inside. They were an improved version of electrical eggs, which gave off unusual lights when the primitive air pumps removed some of the air inside. Geissler's tubes became famous for their better quality and vacuum. Geissler tubes soon became used to do some unusual chemistry. Geissler suggested in 1858 to Liebig that gases could be identified chemically by means of the electrical discharge in these tubes. Geissler did exactly this in 1868, telling about a vacuum tube in which liquids trapped inside minerals could be identified chemically by means of spectroscopy. Geissler also converted white phosphorus into the red phosphorus form using the electrical discharge within the tubes. Simultaneously, Julius Plücker did his own electrical investigations inside Geissler tubes. The electrical discharge, he found, caused a fluorescent glow on the inside of the tubes. The quality of the vacuum also affected the glow. With a better vacuum, the glow faded away, but near the anode, the glass glowed green. The glow could be moved around if you placed a magnet near the tube, indicating that the glow was related to electricity. By this time, electricity and magnetism were known to be related, and James Clerk Maxwell was working on his equations of electromagnetism. Geissler's tubes were improved still further by English physicist William Crookes by 1875, and able to sustain an even more rarefied vacuum. Crookes placed a piece of metal, famously in the shape of a German iron cross, inside a tube and showed that it cast a shadow. Clearly the glow was caused by some kind of ray flowing from the cathode to the anode. Where the metal blocked the ray, the shadow fell. And with this, Crookes also showed that Benjamin Franklin's hypothesis about electricity from over a century earlier, that it flowed from positive to negative, was backwards. Crookes, though he discovered the element thallium, found the spectrum of helium on Earth, and even invented a 100% UV-blocking lens for sunglasses, was also heavily involved in pseudoscience, that is, believing in spiritualism and mediums, particularly from the late 1860s through the mid-1870s. He was the butt of a number of spiritualist jokes, in which fakers foisted spiritualist effects on Crookes, such as a young woman dressed up as a ghost. He was criticized as having poorly controlled psychic experiments, and the end result was that his excellent reputation in science was tainted. Scientists still had no idea what were those mysterious rays or what electricity was, but it clearly traveled in straight lines, otherwise there would be no sharp shadow cast. The vague term chosen to describe this phenomenon was radiation. In 1876, German physicist Eugen Goldstein called this type of radiation Kathodenstrahlen, or cathode rays, because they emanated from a cathode and went to the anode. Were these cathode rays light, which traveled in straight lines, or particles? If particles, they could be so light and moved so fast that their motion was almost unaffected by gravity. Generally, the German scientists, like Goldstein, promoted the wave hypothesis, while the English scientists voted for the particle hypothesis, since Faraday's ionic work hinted at particles. The Irish physicist George Stoney even named non-conducting particles in an atom in 1891 as electrons, but his nephew George Fitzgerald offered the name electron in 1894 to such hypothetic electrical particles. In 1892, German physicist Heinrich Hertz found that these cathode rays would pass through thin gold or aluminum leaves. That seems odd for the case of particles, for atoms should be blocked by other atoms. If particles, you can show this by deflecting them with a magnetic field. Already Plücker and Crookes showed this to be true. But with Maxwell's electromagnetic theory now available, you can use it to see if charged particles were deflected also by an electric field. In 1897, Joseph John Thompson, colloquially known as J.J. Thompson, did this exact experiment at Cambridge University in Cavendish Laboratory. A particle in a cathode ray is deflected in a known electric field by an amount related to its mass and electric charge. As he put it in his article, Cathode Rays, in 1897, quote, "Something charged with negative electricity is shot off from the cathode, traveling at right angles to it, and that this something is deflected by a magnet," unquote. He also determined that their speed was something like 1/10 the speed of light. Hence, Thompson found the ratio of the particle's mass to its charge, but he couldn't determine each independently. Thompson won the Nobel Prize in 1906. Just by logic, we have two choices. Let's assume that the electron particle is the same mass as the smallest known mass in 1897, the hydrogen atom. If so, it had to have enough electric charge to be hundreds of times more charged than a hydrogen ion. Or, let's assume the particle has the same size charge as a hydrogen ion. If so, its mass had to be hundreds of times smaller than the hydrogen atom. More likely, it was the second choice, that is, its charge is the same size as that of the hydrogen ion, with a much, much smaller mass than a hydrogen atom. From 1908 to 1913, American Robert Millikan showed the actual electron charge to be that of one hydrogen atom, and the mass was 1/1837 of a hydrogen atom. The apparatus used to determine this value was quite clever. He and his student, Harvey Fletcher, took a glass container and placed it between two electrodes to give an electric potential inside the container. The researchers sprayed tiny oil droplets into the chamber. The droplets fell because of gravity, but the air prevented them from accelerating much. Then they switched on the electric field. Some drops had a natural electric charge on them and responded to the field by rising. The researchers watched through a microscope some of the droplets. The researchers could balance gravity downward against electric force upward and keep a likely drop at bay. In this way, they could calculate the charge on the drop directly. Millikan won the Nobel Prize in 1923, partially for this experiment. There is some controversy, however, over possible coercion Millikan exerted on Fletcher for giving up authorship of the final paper in exchange for a PhD dissertation. In any case, clearly we have a particle smaller than an atom, and Dalton's idea of an unsplittable atom began to crumble. This electron was the actual atom of electricity Faraday's research led to, and we now regard J.J. Thompson as the discoverer of electrons. The next question was, how are electrons related to atoms? Are they independent of each other? And do electrons have anything to do with chemistry at all? Suddenly, several answers became clear. We know from Bunsen and Kirchhoff's work in spectroscopy that different elements have characteristically different spectra. We also know from Maxwell's equations that electric charge vibrating makes electromagnetic waves, that is, light. It seems reasonable to assume that something electrical inside atoms, the electron, is doing the vibrating and causing different atomic spectra. We can call this an electronic theory of matter. Let's add one caveat to this approach. We assume that electrons, like all known matter at that time, behaved in accordance with Newton's laws. That assumption will soon have to be modified, which we will see when we get to quantum theory. But it's clear that electrons are related to atoms. How about chemistry, though? With the discovery of the electron, some chemists regarded this as evidence of Arrhenius's ionized atoms in solution. You can imagine in some cases electrons somehow attaching themselves to atoms, making negative ions. For example, the chloride ion would be an electron plus a chlorine atom. A sulfate group would be a sulfur atom, 4 oxygen atoms, plus 2 electrons. A phosphate group would be a phosphorus atom, 4 oxygen atoms, plus 3 electrons. All cool. But then what about positively charged ions like sodium ions or hydrogen ions or ammonium ions? No one knew of a positively charged particle. Maybe you took away an electron from each one to make a positive ion. But if you supposed that, you immediately had to suppose that atoms had some kind of internal structure with electrons and some kind of positive balancing charge. Maybe atoms weren't indivisible. And there was even some evidence to support this. Thomas Edison, the American inventor, but also a chemist at times, in 1883 found a most unusual phenomenon associated with his glass globes under vacuum, the first electric light bulbs. If he heated up a filament, which is carrying electricity, he could detect an electric current from another positively charged electrode inside the globe. Apparently, heating the filament to glowing allowed negative electricity to boil off, if you like, and get attracted to a positive electrode. This phenomenon is now called the Edison effect. The Edison effect would be harnessed in about 2 decades by John Fleming and Lee DeForest for what we in America call vacuum tubes, and in the UK, valves. With vacuum tubes, you can have true electronics, amplification within radios, televisions, stereos, electronic computers, and all the perks of 20th century life. Hertz found a weird effect in 1888. He was jumping an electric spark across a gap between 2 electrodes while doing early research into radio waves. When he shined an ultraviolet light on the cathode during the experiment, a spark jumped more easily. Eventually, this was termed the photoelectric effect. In 1902, Philip Lennard, an assistant of Hertz, found that the photoelectric effect came from electrons being ejected from metals when light shone on the metals. The electrons even jumped out of metals when no electricity was passing through the metal. Therefore, it seemed clear that metal atoms, and likely all atoms, contained electrons. But, as I mentioned, there had to be a balancing positive charge, because in general, atoms are neutral. Where is the positive charge? A number of different ideas appeared in the scientific world to explain this problem in quick succession, starting in 1903. Likely, you've heard of one of these models, but not the others. So here goes. Lennard himself suggested in 1903 that atoms contained clouds of electrons, and clouds of positive particles twinned up in, as he called them, dynamids. Except nobody ever saw positive particles coming out of atoms, only negative electrons. So this view seemed overall unlikely. Where were the equivalent positive particles? Like Crookes, Lennard also had some psychological issues. In Lennard's case, Lennard became exceedingly anti-Semitic and harbored resentment at others' scientific successes in the early decades of the 20th century, even as he won the Nobel Prize in 1905 for his work on cathode rays. By the 1920s, he was actively supporting the Nazi Party, and he labeled Albert Einstein's work as Jewish physics, which helped lead to the Nazi Party's nationalistic science movement called Deutsche Physik. J.J. Thomson the following year offered the idea that atoms were solid blobs of positive material with negative electrons randomly sitting throughout. In England, the metaphor of the plum pudding took hold, and that's often the term for Thomson's atomic model today, the plum pudding model. As an American, plum puddings aren't overly familiar to me, so I prefer my own ice cream metaphor. That is, mint ice cream with randomly placed chocolate chips throughout. Or maybe you prefer Isaac Asimov's metaphor, raisins in a pound cake. Whichever culinary metaphor you like, this is probably the model you've heard of in a basic physics or chemistry class. A Japanese physicist, Hantaro Nagaoka, disliked Thomson's model, for, he said, opposite charges are impenetrable. Instead, Nagaoka suggested that maybe there is a blob of positive charge in the center of the atom, and electrons orbit around the positive center, like planets around the sun or rings around the planet Saturn. The problem with Nagaoka's planetary model is that such rings are inherently unstable, and the electron would spiral into the central positive blob. He retracted his model in 1908. Lord Rayleigh, whom we met in the 1890s finding inert gas elements, had his own view, from 1906, which was a kind of variant of Thomson's model. He regarded an atom as a large enough blob of electrons together to make the electricity inside like a continuous fluid, which can vibrate at known frequencies. We might call this the electron-fluid model. One problem with his model was that the vibrational frequencies didn't correspond with any observations, that is, spectra. Also that year was James Jeans's model, incorporating electrons with their own internal structure, but also studded throughout a sea of positive charge like Thomson's model. We might call this the vibrating electron model. A truly bizarre model from 1906 was offered by George Schott, British mathematician. He suggested that atoms include electrons expanding at an extremely slow rate, so that various vibrational frequencies could be observed. We have already heard of the law of conservation of energy, so maybe the expansion is opposed by some internal stress. Schott hypothesized a pressure from the supposed medium through which light travels, the now debunked ether. Yeah, no. Weird factoid about Schott? While the quantum revolution was roiling physics from this time through the 1920s, Schott remained staunchly anti-quantum to his death in 1937. We will encounter the quantum theory soon in a later episode. The final hypothesis I discuss here was proposed in 1910 by German physicist Johannes Stark. He suggested that maybe atoms were made of rings of tiny magnets as some kind of positive particle, more or less paired up with electrons. He called this model the archion model. In our next episode, we learn about another discovery that changed science forever, the X-ray. Until then, brave the elements! Thank you for listening to the History of Chemistry podcast.